Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
And we welcome back to RCR Greenwashed, Owen Jennings. He's a regular contributor for us on our show, and we're very grateful for him and all for his input. He's an all-round good guy, former MP and former president of Federated Farmers of New Zealand way back in about 1990. But more importantly, we've got him here today to give us a 101 on why a man that started his career in farmer politics in Karamea on the West Coast, all of a sudden, or not all of a sudden, evolved his thinking into understanding why New Zealand needed to have open markets, unsubsidized farming, and how that played out in the 1980s. Now, Owen, I know that you were not the national president of Federated Farmers at the time of the reforms of 1985, the Roger Douglas reforms, you might call them. But you were right at the coalface with Brian Chamberlain and others in Federated Farmers. Could you talk us through what, firstly, encouraged you to have this mindset that said New Zealand couldn't carry on being subsidised in terms of its primary production? And secondly, how did you influence people around you at the time? Mm. So welcome back to RCR. Keen to have your story.
Well, good morning. Good to be with you. It was rather interesting. I guess the pivotal point was a meeting with Muldoon, Sir Robert Muldoon, who was both Prime Minister and Minister of Finance at the time. So this is probably mid to late-ish 1983. But the situation was pretty grave. On-farm inflation was 22%. Interest rates were in the high teens. We had fertilizer subsidies. We had sheep farmers 80-85% dependent on subsidy income to survive, and not a dissimilar situation in dairy. Everything looked bad. We sat down in Federated Farmers and decided what we needed to seek from the government to maintain our economic position, our relative position. And what we were looking at was asking for fertiliser subsidies to be increased, land development loans to be increased, interest rates to be artificially pinned down. We just had a long list of things that were essential if farming was just going to retain its, or farmers going to retain their, you know, their present income levels. And we looked at that list and we said two things. One, it was not achievable. No government would bow to that kind of level of support. And two, it wasn't sustainable. It, instinctively, one knew, even with limited understanding of economics, that that was a road to nowhere. We were, you know, we were heading towards the cliff. So we went to see Muldoon, and there were two meetings. The first one was reasonably mild. We explained the situation to him, and we didn't really get a very useful response from him. But we went back to a second one, and it's deeply imprinted in my mind because we were barely in the door, and we were really opened the batting by saying the position was untenable, it wasn't sustainable. We had to really face some drastic action. We didn't know what that action was at that point, but we just knew that something had to happen. And we got a lecture from Muldoon on Bretton Woods and on world economics and how he was recognized around the world as a master of handling economies. And we dug in a bit, and he virtually ordered us out of his office. And his final words were, "You look after the farmers, I'll look after the country." We went back to our office and we sat down as a group of executive of Federated Farmers under Peter Elworthy, Brian Chamberlain, and a couple of others. And we sat there and we looked at each other and we said, you know, where do we go? If he's re-elected, we're going to be in absolutely dire straits. And there was a bit of self-interest involved because we knew that if we didn't jack up the subsidies and the help, farmers would do even worse than they were doing, and our position became untenable as farming leaders. So somebody said, why don't we find out what the Labor Party's doing and thinking at the moment? And we didn't even know who their financial spokesman was, because, you know, Federated Farmers in those days was known as the National Party in gumboots. You didn't have anything to do with Labor. They were sort of way out on a limb. So we found out that some guy called Roger Douglas, who was at that time sort of known as a pig farmer in Auckland, was running their finance portfolio. He was overseas, and they sent a guy along called Peter Nielsen to meet us, who happened to be a Miramar MP at the time. We didn't know who he was. He sat down across the table. We said, look, here's the situation. This is what we're facing. And he looked us in the eye and he said, well, if you elect Labor, we'll change all that. Subsidies will be gone. We'll do this, this, and this. We'll float the dollar. We thought, goodness gracious, what's this about? One of the things we did was we made a couple of trips up to the Reserve Bank, because sitting in the Reserve Bank was a guy called Don Brash, who was later to leave Reserve Bank business and become, of course, leader of both National and ACT, and get involved in politics in what was not a particularly famous career. But he was certainly very well acquainted with the issues in economics. And we sat down with him, and he said, look, these are the things that are going to be important for the future of New Zealand. And it involved some really radical reforms. He said, if you want to get a situation better for farming for the medium and long term, your key enemy is inflation. And there was a small story, and it's funny how often it's small stories that impact you. I was aware of a situation in Japan, a fairly personal situation. The Japanese were buying some product from New Zealand. We were expecting them to pay 20% more for the produce that we were exporting to Japan when they had an inflation rate of 1% or 2%. And they said, why would we pay more? You know, sorry, the problem's yours. It's not ours. And it kind of drove home to me, amongst other things, the absolute importance of getting your own economy right, particularly when you've got that exposure to export. So That's where it began. A lot of it began in Muldoon's office, Don Brash's office, and just some really intensive research on our own account to find out what we needed to do to really turn the economy around.
Look, I remember those years, Owen. Of course, I was very junior and struggling to survive. It was tough times by mid-80s. Having come to farming with a decent chunk of change in my pocket, it was all gone by 87 anyway. And insolvency was around the corner for me. Interestingly, survived, so that's my story, but I don't want to make it about me. There's some key points you make in that last couple of minutes. One, that the farmers of New Zealand thought National Party held it together for them always. You could trust the National Party implicitly. They would do the right thing by you. And having to turn that on its head was the biggest thing you faced, in my opinion, because all I ever heard when Federated Farmers and then Roger Douglas came out with this big proposal in December, about December the 13th, I think it was, 1985, there was a tax package that changed everything. All I heard in my neighborhood is, and I'll paraphrase here, those bastards, look what they've done to us. And you had to face a maelstrom of just abuse in my area. Everything was rotten. Everything was wrong. But I suppose it's when you look back and you can, in the cold light of day, you can actually sort of accept that people were hurt. They didn't know what was right or wrong. And it took a lot of us perhaps 10 years to get through that.
It did. And it was severe and it made a huge impact. And, you know, I've sat in kitchens along with other Federated Farmers leaders, sat in kitchens around New Zealand, farm kitchens, and heard people say, our mortgages is $300,000, our farm valuation's now $200,000, what do we do? And, you know, we've got the bank knocking on our door, we've got creditors that we can't cope with. It was, from a personal point of view, an individual farming point of view, it was a frightening, very deeply disturbing time. And we all shared that. I mean, because the same situation existed at home. It was a matter of what Labor did. Was it right or wrong? Or was it the correct recipe at the time? Mm. I would argue that our research showed that there was no other option but to go down that road. What made it more difficult for agriculture in the short and medium term was that the reforms stopped halfway through the process. And had the rest of the economy been reformed to the same degree and in the same format, then agriculture would have come through more quickly, more effectively, and come out the end in much better shape, because the subsidies that came off us first meant that we were leaner, thinner, and ready to go, whereas the rest of the economy was still deeply held back by issues like, you know, too high a government expenditure, too much interference, too much a lack of productivity in the state sector, etc. So that was the mistake that was made. It wasn't the mistake wasn't doing the reforms. The mistake wasn't delivering on all of the reforms.
I recall that famous cup of tea from Prime Minister Longy at the time. And yeah, there was other aspects to it, wasn't there? The round that Roger Douglas wanted to, sorry, I'm getting off farming here for a minute. We wanted a flat tax regime, lower, flatter taxes. And you know, GST came in around the same time, I recall. So there was lots of things. So just a quick overview of that, perhaps. Owen, have you got any comment?
There was, and, you know, Douglas's theme is always, when you reform quickly. You go in giant steps, and, you know, you move as fast as you possibly can. But you also go out and talk to people. And one of the astounding things about that period was whenever we said to Douglas, Preble, even Longy, look, you need to come and front up to the farmers at Invercargill or Paiatua or Kaitaia, they did. They always found somebody who was willing to go out. And I've walked into the halls alongside Douglas and Preble, and you could feel the heat, you could feel the anger, you know, walking up the aisle between hundreds of angry farmers, and they would stand up and tell their story. And, you know, farmers, to their great credit, began to understand that there wasn't an option, that there was only one way to go. And, you know, the thing that angered farmers as much as anything was, why didn't National do that? Why had National allowed the economy to deteriorate to the point where these massive reforms were necessary? And I think that did the National Party a lot of harm during that period. A lot of people have not really forgiven them for that.
Yeah, and sorry, my view today is that not much has changed, actually, because there's now this massive urban influence that the mainstream parties have to pander to, and farming vote, while it's still 6% of New Zealanders, I think, live inside farm gates or support farming, and about 14 to 15% live in regional New Zealand, we are a minority under the democratic system we have in this country, which is the right system in terms of one person, one vote. MMP seems to have altered the dynamic considerably.
Yeah. There's an old adage in politics that is, you know, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. Mm. And it's very, very true that, you know, we all want a better outcome. We all want better wages. We want our money to buy more goods for us. We want a better home and a better life. Mm. But often we're not prepared to take the necessary medicine will allow that to happen. And historically, unfortunately, National has been a fiddling party rather than a reforming party. When they needed to reform, they haven't. I mean, even this last budget, I mean, which has been blown up as being, you know, such a major development, a major change, it's actually spending more taxpayers' money than Robertson did, for goodness sake. Yeah. You know, people haven't really analysed for what it is. It's unfortunately, again, tinkering around the edges without attacking the heart of the problem, and that is that government has got too big in our economy. It's too dead a weight.
Yeah, and that was the key message for me out of the 80s reforms, actually. And I was, as I said, very junior, my nose was to the grindstone rather than thinking about politics, was that the dead weight of government was a problem to farming. And it's continued to be so, more so every year since, especially the RMA was reformed and was put out in 1991, enacted in 1991. I've got a view that we've been taking all the heat on in the environmental front and climate change front when there's so many people outside our gate that are feeding off everything we do. And I think we have to start labeling those people as bludgers. They are absolutely bludging from the environment and putting all the blame on farming. So it's almost like society did a 180 on us, Owen. And it's up to people like you and I to actually keep the foot on the throat, or try to, because I don't know what's next. We've got this interview was never going to be about this, but we'll take it to this point at the moment. We've got 20% rate increases this year in most of our councils locally and even around New Zealand. There's plenty of years when it has been that much as well, and all those employees and environment councils around New Zealand think they're doing something for the environment.
What?
They're doing the exact opposite in most cases. There's very little environmental enhancement happening for them. Billions of dollars each is spent since they formed. And yet they say to society, look at us, we're doing the right thing by the environment. Well, I would say, in Southland sense, I would guess there's been $1 billion go through Environment Southland since it started.
Well, when we faced the reforms in the 80s, we were dealing with central government. And, you know, there wasn't, I mean, okay, we were involved with local government issues, but fundamentally it was thought that central government controlled and dominated the economy. I've got to say right now, it's much more local government that is providing us with the headaches and the major problems facing agriculture. The dead weight of local government and the move from sort of rats, rates and whatever, water or whatever it is that saying, to having powers of general competence, giving local government the right to do whatever they wanted to do, whether it was erect a statue in the middle of the park or buy a hotel or embark on, you know, many of these escapades that they have. A, they're not equipped to do it. B, the incentives inside the system don't exist for them to do that in a economic and sensible way, and it's a diversion from the things that really do affect us: potholes, water rates, land rates, etc. So, yeah, I think the next major reform has got to happen at local government level.
If I may button at this point, gentlemen, now, with my very, very minute sense of history of New Zealand, I became here 15 years ago. And one of the key points that got my husband and I here, coming from the agrarian community in India, the Sikhs, was the fact that there was no subsidy regime. This was something that was, you know, in Indian papers, Indian, especially in Punjab, because there's a lot of agriculture publications around. My father-in-law retired as senior bank manager of PADB, Primary Agriculture Development Bank. for the district, and everything worked on subsidies. Without that, nothing worked. The economics just didn't make sense. And the moment he heard that there's nothing there, and he and my husband and like, yep, that's a place to go. If you are going to go farming, that's a place to go. Then this year, earlier this year, they were here, my father-in-law again, and he saw me one morning getting ready, heading off to council. And I was muttering something. He was like, well, what are you talking about? I said, Dad, do you realize? I said, Delhi has 35 million people. We call it the NCR region, 35 million. I said, New Zealand is 5 million. We have 78 councils and unitary bodies. He was like, you're kidding me. He was. Yeah. He actually thought I'm joking. I said, no. I said, I am not kidding. Did you realize that? Then he laughed at me. He said, did you realize that 15 years ago when you moved? I said, you got me there. No, I said, true. No, I didn't. I said, no, I did not. And when you were talking now of, you know, erecting statues and all of this, it's a sense of deja vu. There, we had our leaders put up, have vanity projects, someone putting up a statue of a god, someone of an elephant, some other religious deity. And we are doing the same stuff here now, aren't we?
Well, government isn't equipped in any way. Political bodies are not equipped in any way to handle commercial issues. I mean, it's just as simple as that.
It's not their job.
Everything's wrong about it. It's costing this country an enormous amount at the present time. And even the, you know, Don, you mentioned the increased staffing. One of the things that haunted me about the 91 RMA when it came in was that councils had to take on a lot of staff to do these plans, these district plans and regional plans. And when they'd done them, they started on water plans and transport plans and whatever. And when they'd done more plans than you could throw poke a stick at, they said, well, somebody's got to make sure these plans work and catch all the people that aren't obeying our plans. So they became, grubby little inspectors looking under stones everywhere and finding people and whatever. There was never a point when we said, well, look, we've got all our plans. All you people can go and find a job in the private sector. Mm-hmm. It's got some real value. No, we just kept them on.
Environmentalism is a bottomless pit. There is the cost value analysis there?
Yeah, and of course you've got to review the plans every 10 years, and that's another minefield. Hey, we digress considerably. I wanted to get back to international trading parameters now. You were involved in plenty of trade delegations overseas, no doubt with the governments of the time. And then in your political career. But how did that start? There was the GATT rounds, I recall, were in Uruguay, where there was significant changes made to the trading regimes of the world. Can you just give us a bit of a 101 on all that period of your time too?
Yes, it's interesting. You really, I suppose, need to go back to the Second World War. And I know that sounds, we don't need a lesson in history, but we do. Because what happened with the submarine blockade of Britain, Britain was down to 3 or 4 days' food during the Second World War. And after the war, Churchill, Adenauer, and de Gaulle got together and said, you know, that was untenable. It was not right that we should have allowed a situation to arise where, you know, our countries could have starved and we would have been losing, you know, thousands of people to starvation. And so they said one of the things we need to do is adopt a food security policy. And that food security policy really led to the formation of the EEC, the European Economic Community, and that cornerstone of that was subsidies to farmers to make sure they could produce enough to keep Europe alive and out of starvation. Over the years, what transpired was, of course, that subsidies can be manipulated. I remember going onto a farm in Ireland and having to wait to drive through a herd of cows to get up to the farmhouse, got to the farmhouse, got talking to the farmer, and he showed me a check for a huge amount of money. And he said, I've just received that from the government for culling my cows. When I asked him how he could get a check for culling his cows when clearly there was a herd out in the paddock, and he said, well, I did a cut a deal with the abattoir owner. He gets half the check, I get the other half, as long as he can show some papers that he's culled, that, you know, he's culled all my cows. And you know, there were just hundreds and hundreds of instances of gross abuse, and to a point where not farming people, but consumers and others started to react against that. And government leaders recognised that it was untenable. But more importantly, there was a growing feeling around the world that trade was what made countries wealthy, that doing business with each other, ultimately doing what you do well, trading that with somebody for something that somebody else did better than you, was absolutely pivotal towards growing wealth, growing prosperity. And so by the time the Uruguay round came round, that feeling was alive and well. Europe were holding on to their subsidies. The Americans pretended they didn't have any, but of course were almost as bad. And of course the Japanese were protecting their rice situation come hell or high water. But some very able negotiations, and New Zealand played a major part in this. We forget that we were key players in the first instance shifting subsidies from produce to property. All right. Mm. So instead of encouraging farmers to produce more milk or more meat, the subsidy went onto the land for protecting the land, enhancing the land, which meant there was not so much produce. Now, the key person in that was a New Zealand trade negotiator. And, you know, we played a major role in having that very subtle change come through. And that's really why we've been allowed as a country, as an food exporter, to do as well as we've done over the last decades.
Who was that trade negotiator, Owen? Can you remember?
Tim Grocer.
Tim Grocer, yeah. And he ended up an MP for about three terms, I imagine, in the National Party, and he ended up the Minister for Climate Change as well. And I had high respect for him, actually. But in the end, he got, to me, the poison chalice ministry called Climate Change. And sadly,
he was never as good in politics as he was in trade negotiations, believe me.
I watched him on the stage in Hong Kong for the first time at a massive trade delegation there in 2004 or 2005. The oral skills of that guy, unbelievable. But if that sort of taught me the language that these people have to speak in, and I'm sorry, it isn't my language. I couldn't be a trade negotiator for all the tea in China. It's so subtle. Their little intonations make quite a difference to the people.
I mean, it was always fun being up alongside the Australians because we were often bundled in with them, as you know. Mm. The Australians were brash, direct, sometimes just too pointed, whereas New Zealand, we've just got a bit more of the Brit finesse, you know, we kind of know how to tone it down a little when we need to when you're on the international stage.
Mm. So, listeners,
I guess the thing, John, that is important to point to make here is because people have asked me, including yourselves, you know, why did I go off into the third world and spend time and energy trying to help farmers in Nepal or Thailand or Myanmar, India? You know, it's people suggest it was out of character with somebody who was in politics here.
Politics.
And yet, if you think about it, it wasn't, because in a way, besides the whole issues of charity and justice and you know, a love for humanity, I remember, was it Desmond Tutu who made the comment that about humanity being, my humanity is your humanity, or something similar to that. Besides all of that, kind of Judeo sort of Christian ethic that we grew up with, there's a lot of self-interest involved. If India the wealth of India increases, then the chances that you and I can do more trade with our produce increases as well. So helping farmers get set up in Malaysia, like I am at the moment, is partly self-interest. It's about making sure that Malaysia, the Malaysian economy, grows, strengthens, has a greater ability to buy what we do well here. And in that regard, you know, trade and aid go together. The tragedy is that much of the aid that is dispensed by governments and by international agencies has exactly the opposite effect. I mean, I was in Zimbabwe when the Americans fed a whole lot of grain as aid into Zimbabwe and destroyed the local farming community in a flash. And you know, a lot of that aid goes down the wrong channels. It's pinched by bureaucrats. There are people who get fat off the back of reselling it to another country. There's all sorts of weird stuff goes on. When you are working one-on-one at a low level, you can really affect change. I remember, for example, being in Nagaland, which is a part of India tucked away up behind Bangladesh. And the farmers there were what's called subsistence farmers. They cut down the local bush and trees and farmed it for a year or two until they couldn't get any more value out of it. And they moved on to another block. And the block they were on just slipped down into the river and, you know, caused even more flooding in Bangladesh. And they said to me, what do you think we could do that would improve things? And they knew it was wrong. They knew they had to change. But a little bit of technology and a little bit of help and encouragement, we were able to, you know, introduce things like, for example, fish farming, using tilapia to provide protein in their diet. But it meant that they could stay on the original block, care for that block, improve the environmental outcomes, improve their food production. And you could say, well, how does that help New Zealand? Well, the people in Nagaland are richer today, wealthier than they were as a result of that, and they're more able to buy our milk powder and our refined dairy products.
And in those areas, do they have private property rights when they do this?
Well, that was one of the interesting things, because property rights virtually didn't exist. And one of the first things I said, hey, guys, we're going to have to get some square pegs and push them around, push them into the ground around your piece of land, because without that, there's no incentive for you to do the right thing. You can afford to walk away because it's not your land. When it's your land, it's identified as your land, you take a greater interest, you take greater care. Now, private property rights are ultimately the cornerstone, the very basic cornerstone of all development.
Yeah, I agree. Owen, how many countries have you been to doing that sort of work? We're certainly not giving this enough time today, but you've been to at least a dozen, I gather.
Yeah, it would be probably like that. Certainly, we set up coffee plantations in Thailand with farmers who were growing opium poppies, which was an interesting exercise because the opium poppies really... they didn't really make a lot of money out of it. All the money was made by middlemen. And so we said, look, you guys could make more money out of coffee. We'll set up a coffee cooperative so that you can, you know, pool your product and market it as one product. And, you know, that's transformed the hill country areas up behind Chiang Mai and Chiang Rai. Yeah, Myanmar, that was pretty hard going. We introduced pig farming into Myanmar, India, Nepal, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and more latterly in Malaysia, and probably a host of other ones as well. But certainly they were the main countries. And look, the surprising thing that I think a lot of people never get their head around, it takes so little to make a difference. I was never spending more than, you know, a few hundred dollars in any one kind of operation or project or site or whatever. It's just so easy to make a difference there. And it's not about going in and telling them what to do. It's about going through into an area, identifying the leadership. In every community, doesn't matter where you go in the world, there's those that lead and there's those that follow. You identify the leader or leaders, and you provide them with the resources so they can do what they know they already have to do. I've been in Nepal with a guy called Naranjan Adhikari, and he's a brilliant guy. And you know, when Naranjan came to me, he said, this is what we need to do for these people. This is how we need to make a difference, because we've got arsenic in the water. We need to get that arsenic out of the water. It's affecting the health of our children, da, da, da. Look, all we had to do was introduce the technology that cleaned the arsenic out of the water. It wasn't difficult. It's technology that's well known, except they didn't know it. They didn't have access to it. It's not expensive technology. So it's about identifying the leader, equipping the leader, resourcing the leader to achieve what they already want to achieve. It wasn't my brains. It wasn't my technologies that made the difference. It was their technology. It was their leadership with a little help.
Meanwhile, we have Luxon recently giving $41 million on behalf of New Zealanders to the Southeast Asian Clean Energy Project. Just this weekend gone, they have spoken about, I think it's $21 million to Niue for a renewable energy project. Fonterra has spent millions of its farmers' money setting up farms in China, in Sri Lanka, and there's no accountability. And yet we look at what you've been doing on, you know, the smell of an oily rag. The contrast is stunning, Owen.
It is. And it's so easy to go into the third world and think you know it all and think you can tell them what to do. And so many times that happens. So much money's been spent in that kind of mode, and unfortunately so often it backfires. And people get disappointed, you know, because they say, well, look, I gave this organization $100 to do something in, I don't know, in Nigeria or wherever it might be. And I know that it was wasted. You know, that's the tragedy of it. People get really disgruntled with aid agencies because they do the wrong thing, they have the wrong approach, the wrong attitude. It's really important to understand that it's about empowering local leadership. They know what they need, they know what they want, they know how to make it happen. All you got to do is be there to support them, resource them, and let it all happen.
Yeah, and look, Owen, we're grateful for your life's experiences around the reforms of the 80s in New Zealand and your mission work. It's interesting, if I could sum up, it's a bit like if you don't learn from history, you're condemned to repeat it. And in the terms of the trade and the sort of the subsidy systems in New Zealand, we seem to be repeating, just without the farming side of it getting involved, the subsidies to others. All using the environment. And you're right, in the mission work, I think property rights and local leadership is fundamental. So look, Owen, grateful to have you back. You've got a wealth of knowledge that we love hearing about, and we'd love to do it again because you're so eloquent and so willing to put your story and what you've lived through. It's not everyone understood it. And they still won't, until they actually hear it and hear it and hear it again. It was a hard time, the 80s. You battled through it. And New Zealand farmers, if they don't appreciate the work you did, more pity them, because I certainly did. Thanks, Owen, for coming back on RCR Greenwashed. And we'll talk to you again soon on the Methane Science Accord stuff, no doubt.
Thank you.
Thank you, Owen. Bye-bye.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.